Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan on this Tuesday, September 10, 2024. Human Rights Watch researcher for South Sudan says the transitional revitalized government should form a hybrid court for South Sudan.
We believe that if there is genuine political will and genuine commitment to establish this court will achieve a life of day.
And a member of parliament in South Sudan says old age and the current economic situation has crippled the ability of lawmakers.
All these are supposed to be addressed by those three acts. Which is dealing hybrid court is supposed to be a criminal justice that deals with serious crimes which cannot be tried in just time.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A parliamentary committee in South Sudan is looking at two bills passed into law by the parliament last week. The two bills will establish Commission for Truth, Reconciliation, Healing and Compensation and Reparations Authority. Human Rights Watch researcher for South Sudan, Nyagwa Tut, says much needs to be done to ensure a credible process of advancing justice is accomplished in the country.
The Revitalized Transitional National Assembly passed two bills. One was on the creation of a Commission for Truth, Reconciliation and Healing, and the other was a Compensation and Reparations Authority. Now, as you know, war broke out in South Sudan in December 2013. And since that time, there have been various abuses of human rights, including war crimes and crimes against humanity that have been committed by all sides in the conflict. This has included murders, killings, sexual violence, recruitment of children into armed forces, the looting and destruction of civilian property, destruction of, and looting of humanitarian aid. So all these are crimes under international law. And so the 2015 agreement, which was signed in 2015, and the agreement that revitalized it in 2018, both these agreements talk about transitional justice.
And what is the fate of the hybrid court? Because I thought it should be part of these transitional justice laws. I thought it was part of that. What happened to the hybrid court?
Tanzo, you're very right. This is a very good question. What is the fate of the hybrid court? What has happened to it? And why is it not receiving as much priority as the other two bills and two laws have? I think the African Union has said that they're trying to communicate with South Sudan through the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, but they're not receiving meetings or they're not receiving communication. The government has also said they're not receiving communication from the African Union. And it seems that they do not have a shared understanding of who is supposed to initiate the next step on the creation of the hybrid court. But these are all semantics. These are all excuses. We believe that if there is genuine political will and genuine commitment to establish this court will achieve a life of day. It is important that there are criminal trials for people that are most responsible for the terrible things that have happened in our country, for the terrible things that South Sudanese have undergone during the crisis, during the war. And so it is important, not to Human Rights Watch, well, to human rights, but to victims and their families, that justice is just not limited to the Truth Commission or to the Reparations Authority, that there has to be a holistic justice that addresses the needs of the people that want to see perpetrators put on trial.
Do you have any recommendations for the specialized parliamentary committees that are going to look at this? Two bills.
So there are a few outstanding issues, knowing that there are no laws that are perfect. One is the Reparations Authority, in as much as it tries to address the relationship between the Truth Commission and the authority, we think there are ways that it could function better. in that, because the reparations authority will be receiving applications from victims who were referred by the Truth Commission. So the authority will be providing symbolic reparation and collective reparations, but only when its mandate is completed. And it will only award, you know, personal reparations where it is not possible to award collective measures. So we think that this puts personal reparations at the end rather than putting them as a priority or as not an option of last resort. We also think it has to be very clear what time period the Truth Commission will be investigating. Now, the peace deal says that the Truth Commission will be trying to look into the happenings since 2005, signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, to the 2018 Peace Agreement. That is the proposal of the 2018 Peace Deal. But as we know, the 2018 Peace Deal was written at a time where people thought the war crimes and the human rights abuses will end when the peace agreement is signed. But since 2018, there have been abuses that have continued. So another option for them to consider is whether it should continue until the end of the transitional period.
When you talk about creating compensation and reparation fund and authority, I'm looking at people whose properties or people who lost everything during the crisis. Is this going to be personal compensation, or is it going to be a group compensation? Bring us up to speed on some of these issues.
Absolutely critical questions, Tanza. And this will be the job of the mechanisms to address. It will be the job of the reparations authority to address how to go about doing this. Now, the definition of how they have the structure or the way the reparations authority is structured is in a very limited way, and that is to compensate both, you know, living persons as well as persons under the law, which is like a business that is created or established in law, is considered a person. And so a business can be compensated for losses that they also suffered during the war.
And your initial reaction to this development was captured in your, you know, report. You say much more remains to be done to ensure credible process to advance justice and uphold victims' rights. What do you mean by credible process?
Right. Yeah, so a credible process starts from the design of the process. It starts from how you recruit the people that will be in charge of this process. Who do you appoint as a commissioner for the Truth Commission? Who do you appoint as the executive of the Reparations Authority? If you are able to shield these processes and mechanisms from political interference, if you're able to ensure that they have adequate budget, and that victims and witnesses can actually access them without fear, then this all contributes to their credibility. It would be a shame if these mechanisms are being established as a ticking box so that the government of the day says, here, we have done it. But then at the end of the day, you have mechanisms and processes that do not deliver their intended goal or their intended objective, which is ensuring that victims, survivors, witnesses, at the end of the day, are receiving justice.
That's Nyagwa Tutpol, Human Rights Watch researcher for South Sudan. She spoke with me from East Africa earlier today. Still on matters to do with Parliament, a lawmaker representing Choi Bet County in the National Legislative Assembly says members of the National Parliament in Juba are divided over issues to do with the formation of the hybrid court for South Sudan. Joel Ngomangek Daniel says most lawmakers worry about their health and where to get the next meal. He says it will take time before a hybrid court is formed in South Sudan.
There were many atrocities committed during that war. From 2013 up to 2017, 2018, that was the climax of the war and killing, plus the rape, plus the destruction of property. All these are supposed to be addressed by those three acts, which is dealing hybrid court is supposed to is a criminal justice that deals with the serious crimes which cannot be tried, it's just done. And then you have the other for compensation and also for healing and reconciliation. But the problem with hybrid courts, there is a lot of opposition to it. The Tumaini was brought in specifically to leave out the issue of hybrid courts. And if you analyze those protocols, they have come in with the issue of amnesty. And under the international law, there are some crimes that cannot be forgiven. You cannot apply amnesty, like war crime, crime against humanity, genocide. And those crimes, they cannot be forgiven, and amnesty cannot apply to them. But they came in with Tumaini trying to come in, to smuggle in the issue of amnesty in order to make those who have committed a crime escape the crimes.
You're using the word they. Who are they?
The top leaders who believe that they are target. Like one of them is the president himself. He's not comfortable with the issue of hybrid courts.
You are a member?
Yes.
Of the SPLM-IO, loyal to first Vice President Riek Machar. Naturally, he would want to oppose anything that President Kiir says. But how do you know that President Kiir is against the formation of the hybrid court? Did he speak to you? Did he tell you that he's against it?
Like the party which is opposing the implementation of the agreement is facing two chapters, security arrangements and chapter 5 of the revitalized agreement is the SPLMIG, where the president it is coming from. And the party which is behind even the Tumaini, they have not come out openly, but they are the one behind this Tumaini. Is the same party is coming here to connect with the SPLMIO, showing that they are now with the SPLMIO in implementation of the agreement. But it's the same person. President Kiir was the one who wrote to Ruto of Kenya to withdraw that one from Rome, because Rome was dealing of how the SOMA will be integrated into the revitalized agreement. But after seeing that this was not solving the problems that they wanted, the President Kiir himself wrote a letter to President Ruto to make sure that he can use his powers as the president and his influence to make sure that the agreement, the negotiation was transferred from Rome to Kenya. And from there, the issue of these protocols, these Tumaini initiative protocols came in. And you have seen within that, there are 7 issues which many people have not understood. But if you analyze those 7 issues, you will see that the main issue of Tumaini to amend or even repeal the revitalized agreement, moving away with those particular 2 chapters, abolishing them and to make sure the name of revitalized agreement was changed into Tumaini, because there is nothing which has changed apart from amnesty plus the issue of political persecution. That because the other leaders in Kenya are much concerned about political persecution.
Someone else would also ask you that since you are in Juba and you're a member of parliament, you've attended the sessions in parliament, why is the parliament not discussing issues to do with the hybrid court? The formation of the hybrid court is long overdue.
Parliament is surviving because of political will. And where there is no political will to deal with a particular issue, it cannot work. This is what we have been saying. We have several issues which are affecting the parliament. One, the financial aspect of it. Now, members of parliament are like another ordinary citizens. They walk to places of work. At the same time, they go home, they beg like another ordinary citizen. That is one. You will never get MPs who beg, who spend some days without food going to talk about these serious issues. That is one. Number two is the issue of revocation. This is an appointed parliament. If somebody has become very serious, he can easily be revoked, because if I was a member of SPLMIG, I would have been revoked long time ago.
What is the use of the parliament if that is how you have reduced yourselves to?
They are not doing intentionally that they, since they are not paid, they cannot do the work. So in this case, the condition, we have elderly members of parliament in the parliament plus 6 individuals. These people are not able to stay for long hours. So they can easily pass the law because they don't have to insist on yet. We have problems in dealing with these issues. Like you need to be well health-wise plus economically for you to fight.
When is the National Legislative Assembly going to debate on these issues to do with the formation of the hybrid court, because it is part of the peace agreement?
When we are dealing with the law, there is a body called this NCAC, National Constitutional Amendment Act. This National Constitutional Amendment Act first draft the law, and then the law is given to Ministry of Justice and come present that bill. Up to now, we have not received that. We have not received the bill on hybrid courts.
Are there any efforts to push the executive to fast-track matters to do with this bill?
The whole issue is now we are heading towards the expiry date of transitional period, which is said to be 22nd. And now we are waiting for the presidency or the high level of revitalization committee to tell us whether there will be extension or there will be election, which I don't think. But we are waiting for them. When it comes now, that is when we shall begin now, because there will be some conditions for extension.
That's Joel Ngomangek Daniel, lawmaker representing Tribet County in the National Legislative Assembly. He spoke to me via WhatsApp from the South Sudan's capital, Juba, earlier today. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Sudanese military authorities reject a proposal for boots on the ground to save lives in Sudan. Find out why after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A UN-backed human rights investigators urge the creation of an independent and impartial force to protect civilians in Sudan, blaming both sides for war crimes, including murder, humiliation, mutilation, and torture. Sudan Armed Forces has rejected the deployment of an independent and impartial force to protect millions of civilians driven from their homes by more than a year of conflict. David Monda, professor of political science at City University in New York, discussed this latest development with VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi.
It's a very difficult position, and it's unfortunate that the Sudanese government has refused an independent external intervention force to try and keep these two belligerent groups separate. The government of General Burhan is still very insecure around the question of sovereignty. Bringing in a foreign intervention force will show that the government is failing in its number one duty to provide for the security of the property and lives of the Sudanese. I think the other challenge with foreign intervention force would also be who would constitute this force, what would their mandate be, and how should they engage when they would be attacked by either the forces of the RSF or the forces of the Al-Burhan administration. So essentially, General Burhan is really afraid about giving up the sovereignty of Sudan and the autonomy that he has in that process. And it's unfortunate because it seems that this humanitarian crisis will continue.
U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, Tom Perelio, started a tour to Riyadh, Cairo, and Ankara to continue urgent efforts to end the war and famine in Sudan, building on the recent success of the Aligned for Advancing Life-Saving and Peace in Sudan initiative. Diplomatic priorities continue to include the coordination of efforts to urge the Sudanese Armed Forces and the RSF to expand humanitarian access in Sudan to ensure the protection of civilians in and seeking the cessation of hostilities. What else could these countries plus the United States do to achieve these goals?
I think they could put diplomatic pressure on both parties, whether the RSF or the Sudanese army, to get to the negotiating table and declare some kind of ceasefire. They can have some kind of arms embargo in terms of the weapons that are coming into these countries. I think they can have travel bans on the top players in both the RSF and the Sudanese government. But I think lastly, they can impose sanctions or threat of sanctions on the Sudanese government should it be resistant to diplomatic efforts. So I think there's a lot they can do, not only diplomatically, but also in terms of access to funds, banking abroad, overseas, and also trade of Sudan and the players in the conflict with, you know, foreign countries. There's a lot that they can still do to put pressure on both factions.
The United Nations World Food Program said on Sunday that Sudan's war for more than 500 days exposed half the population to extreme hunger. The World Food Program announced the entry of food aid to West Darfur with the aim of combating the threat of famine in Sudan. Is this enough to avoid a devastating famine in Sudan?
I think it's a temporary measure that can alleviate or postpone a devastating famine in Sudan, because it's a temporary, it's like a stopgap measure. Particularly, remember the fact that this is a food aid to West Darfur, where the RSF rebels are located. I think the challenge for the World Food Program providing this food aid will be to essentially ensure that the food is secure, that it actually gets to the starving civilians that need it the most. Because part of the challenge and the complexity of this conflict is if that food aid gets into the hands of the rebels or the government forces, it is actually contributing to perpetuation of the conflict, because it will be aiding the parties in the conflict that really don't need this aid. I think the other element that the World Food Program should carefully consider is how to integrate food aid, but also to support peace initiatives, which will allow Sudanese farmers to actually grow food and allow Sudan to be self-sustaining in terms of food production.
That's David Monda, professor of political science at the University, at the City University of New York. He spoke. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump square off Tuesday in Philadelphia for their first presidential debate. Analysts say this historic sluggish, which pits prosecutorial puncher against one of America's best known counterpunchers, could be decisive as they vie for presidency. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
In the Republican corner, former President Donald Trump trying to reclaim the title after a four-year break. And in the Democrat corner, Vice President Kamala Harris, the rising challenger who has Americans wondering whether she can go the distance all the way to the Oval Office. Tuesday evening's presidential debate, with its glossy production values, pre-event taunts, and starkly different contenders, feels like a heavyweight bout. Trump's last debate ended with a knockout. Just weeks after President Joe Biden's lackluster late June debate performance against Trump, Biden announced he would not seek re-election. Now, with Harris just weeks into running as his replacement, she faces Trump on the debate stage. But analysts say it's more than a spectacle. This toe-to-toe contest, where both will vie for points from a deeply split electorate, could be decisive. They bring very different styles to the stage. Trump has jabbed at Harris's intelligence and predicts that his odds against her are better than against his last debate opponent, Biden.
He is a smarter person than she is. Oh, they're waiting for the debate.
And here's Harris taking a short break from debate training.
Look, it's time to turn the page on the divisiveness. It's time to bring our country together. Chart a new way forward.
June's Trump-Biden debate drew more than 51 million U.S. television viewers. Analysts expect big numbers for this matchup, too, and high stakes for both contenders. Nate French teaches communications at Wake Forest University.
Trump has to prove that he can be president, and he has to prove to a lot of the people who are looking at him that he can be as assertive and as aggressive as he wants to be without being rude, if he's going to try to get anybody that might not be currently on the Trump train. Kamala Harris has to prove that she's presidential. She has to prove that she can attack and she can pull back. She has to prove that she can identify where her policies are different than Biden, but still moving in the same Democratic platform.
Moderators will pepper the candidates with questions on major issues like the economy, reproductive rights, foreign policy, and more. Each candidate, given only a pen, paper, and water, has 2 minutes to reply. Jeremy Suri is a history professor at the University of Texas at Austin.
To some extent, the debates give the two candidates a pass because they can state the things they want to do, their aspirations, without having to explain how they will do them. But where it becomes significant is they have to at least say, when they articulate their positions, what they think that will look like.
It all happens here in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, on Tuesday night. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
Still on U.S. elections, the crucial Tuesday presidential debate between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump is being watched closely by Africans. Christopher Isiki is a professor of African politics and international relations at the University of Pretoria. He tells my colleague Chinedu Ofo that the stakes are high because Africa has a huge stake, not only in the outcome of the debate, but also the November election.
There are a couple of different stakeholders that have interest. Centers like mine following the elections closely because we want to know how it pans out because of the fact that we need to be able to craft foreign policy response for states in the continent to know how to engage who, depending on who wins the elections. And then governments, of course, in the continent also have a stake in who wins. For example, if Harris, the Democrats, were to win, it would mean that a country like South Africa would have some hopes that AGOA would be renewed and it has a chance of being listed again as a beneficiary country. Different stakeholders in the continent have interests. Of course, there are also those who just are interested for the fun of it. But yes, the American politics, because of the leadership position that America plays in the world and is giving its stake in Africa, is something that Africans are always interested in, either at the people level or at the state level.
What would you be looking for in this, what people are terming make or break debate?
This debate is an opportunity for both candidates to try to sway undecided voters, especially I think that will be their target. They all have their bases firmly locked in, but the undecided voters, independents as they call them also, are the ones to look out for. It's expected to be a close contest in November. I think that that's what this debate is going to do, giving them the chance to get to explain their policies, what their policy positions are on key issues that will frame the electors. I will be looking at the economy, and that's what's most important to a lot of Americans. The question of immigration, women's reproductive rights will be also featuring, and I think there's also going to be a bit of foreign policy as well. So those are the things you want to look out for, apart from the fact that it presents Kamala Harris an opportunity for Americans to get to know her more, as the debate is not going to be scripted. There are no props or notes allowed. So it will just be the candidates themselves responding intellectually, or as the case may be, to questions that will be asked of them and presenting themselves to the American public.
In politics, people might say there's a defining moment in every politics or in every campaign. Do you think one way or the other, whatever happens in this debate will affect the outcome of this election? Some say a lot of people have made up their minds already.
Yes, a lot of people have made up their minds already, but there's the narrative that the Trump campaign is pushing that Kamala Harris is not able to respond to questions when she's not the one pulling the prosecution, right? And there may be people who would want to get to know that part of her and confirm whether that is correct or not.
That's Christopher Isiki, a professor of African politics and international relations at the University of Pretoria. He spoke with my colleague Chinedu Ofu. That's all we prepared for you this Tuesday, September 10, 2024. We now go slow with the song Muzina by Tabule Reshero. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. If you missed this program, go to www.voaafrica.com for all updates on our programs. On behalf of our producer Kwame Ofori and engineer Cornelius, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Yeah.
Yamusina.